Robert is a licensed psychologist with over 30 years of experience in the mental health field and addiction. And in 1982, he met with 17 other people at the Croc Ranch, and that's when they first met to set up the National Association for Children of Alcoholics. And he also wrote the book, Lost in the Shuffle, about codependency. So let's hear it for Robert.
Thanks. You're very kind. Good afternoon. My name is Bob, and I am a recovering alcoholic and a recovering adult child. In the spirit of the 12 steps, and this being a non-formal kind of conference, I don't know how many of you know Susan Bull, the gal who spent a lot of time and energy with others to set up the conference, but she asked me if I had a title for my talk, and I said, no, I try to trust in the man upstairs and plug into the stream of consciousness that he usually provides for me when I listen to him. So I have some things, though, I do want to talk about that are specific to not so much the beginnings of the adult child movement and what we came to know as the National Association for Children of Alcoholics, but there were so many of us that when we first met, we were invited by the grace of the man upstairs to meet together at this place called the Croc Ranch. And Sharon Wegscheider, you know this name, Jail Greenleaf, Janet Wotitz, Bob Ackerman, people like that were amongst the group of distinguished people I felt privileged to meet back then, to talk about what was our common experience in regards to the different parts of the country we had lived in. Now, I was a recovering alcoholic then, and one of the things that had started to percolate inside of my soul was I came from this dysfunctional family. And when I would talk about my recovery, I would end up slipping into discussions about my mother, my father, my sisters, my half-brother. And the AA people at that time were a little taken aback by discussions that moved beyond just the question of our alcoholism and recovery. And I don't say this with anything but love, but I did not find a welcoming family at that time in the discussions of what we now call the adult child movement. And so I started to go outside of AA. I stayed with my AA program, but I went outside, and I was working as a therapist at that time and working mostly with families. One of my mentors is Virginia Satir, who's now passed, but someone who was very important in setting the stage for my understanding of what later would become recovering codependency kinds of therapy. When we first started to leave AA into the discussion about the adult child of the alcoholic, I ran into Sharon Wegscheider. Sharon is from Minnesota also, and she and I heard of one another, and so we ended up meeting at this by accident sort of conference. And we started talking about our mutual issues. She was working heavily in codependency. I was working heavily in the area of addiction and family chemical dependency issues. And we started to discuss what it meant to be, quotes, a codependent. Now, in the beginning, you know, some of you have been around this program for a long time. How many have been in this for 10 or 15 or 20 years? Okay, so I expect that I don't have to go over all, but if you would like to ask me questions, I'll go back and repeat some things for you. But when we first started to talk about this, Sharon was saying, well, you know, there are all of those of us who lived with the alcoholics and those of us who grew up with the dysfunctional, addictive parents. And we, as children, began to suffer from what I was calling back then a delayed identity development syndrome. Now, I know that sounds very clinical, but you have to remember that I was a clinician, and that when I talked to clinicians, I couldn't talk to them about AA talk. I couldn't talk to them about codependency because they wouldn't know what I was talking about. And so as I started to try to understand how to translate lay terminology, codependency, into clinical terminology, I started to break it down into their familiar language. And when I say to you delayed identity development syndrome, as clinical as that sounds, it's important that you understand words because words mean things. And when you talk about a delay in one's identity, it is a very descriptive way of identifying what happens to us when we live in these dysfunctional families. We're supposed to be going through stages of human development that start with trust. And you've probably had some talk already at this conference about what happens to children when their mothers and their relationship with their mothers is interfered with, how children immediately internalize the sensation of separation from their mothers and later from their fathers, and what the messages of the environment mean to them. And if you think about, and Sharon was big on this, and her mentor was also Virginia Satir, so we had some, you know, those God events coming together, and we started talking about what it was like to grow up in our alcoholic families. She was speaking not as an addict, but she was speaking as a child from an alcoholic family. I was speaking as an addict who was waking up to his dysfunction and his delayed identity. And I was talking about moving out of AA and trying to find room in Al-Anon. Well, I went to Al-Anon, by the way, because I thought that was a pretty brilliant idea. And I went in and sat down. Of course, it was all women back then. And I sat down with them, and I introduced myself. And I started to talk about my alcoholic family, and I felt like I was sitting in a room full of older women. These were 40-year-old women at that time. That was really old. I was 27. And they all looked at me and went, oh. And I could feel that stuff that I felt with my mother. And I thought, nah, this is not the place for me. And I went away from Al-Anon. And when I was talking with Sharon, she was saying, well, you know, and there was a certain kind of pride that alcoholics back had, false pride that we had about making codependents. I mean, codependents didn't just happen, we made them, you know. And I said to Sharon, I said, I don't know how to talk about that with you because I don't know that I made any codependents. Perhaps I did, but I don't know if I've lived long enough to do that. But I want you to know, as a recovering alcoholic, I believe that I am a recovering adult child. And this was the beginning of our discussions of integrating addictive discussions of chemical addiction to the question of codependency. And if I might ask to break anonymity, how many of you are recovering alcoholics in this room? Okay. How many of you who are recovering alcoholics are also adult children? I figured. And I have not met yet, and I haven't in all of my 32 years in recovery, an alcoholic who doesn't talk to me about first and foremost having come from a dysfunctional family. Now, when we talk about dysfunctional family, and that's an important word, dysfunction, because it doesn't say that things aren't working. It says that they're not working basically to their optimum. They're functioning in a sort of crazy, insane, painful way, but it is working. So as a family therapist, and Sharon being mentored by Virginia as a family therapist, we were talking, obviously, that this was a family disease. And that the family unit was, if you put it into a blender, a person. And there were all these different dimensions of personality that made up the system. And that each child that came out of a system of two, three, four, or more children had found their own adaptive way to cope with the pain of living in a separated state. It's not just separated in the sense of trust and emotional bond with their mother and or father, but separated from themselves. This sort of deep longing that I feel still in my life, that something's missing. Now, I have lots of years of clinical experience, lots of years of recovery, but in a spiritual sense, I want to say some things to you to think about. I believe in a higher power. I call that higher power God. I happen to be a Christian. It doesn't matter to me where you assign your faith, but I think if you are an adult child, if you are a human being and you hope to self-actualize in your lifetime, you will have to come to terms with the fact that you are powerless. Now, I'm going to go through a number of triads in this handout that I gave you. I call them triads of adulthood. They are the cornerstones, if you will, for ultimately self-actualization. And so I believe that in this abstract spiritual sense, yes, we have some more over here. Someone's asking for some more handouts. All right. I will repeat questions if you ask me any so that you don't think I'm repeating myself, but the people are recording here. Yes, I have some more of those too. In the spiritual, abstract, existential, however you wish to talk about it sense, I believe that God sent us down here. I think life is something that begins. There's some right there. That life begins at the moment of conception. I'm not into politics with you all, but I want you to know what I believe is the essence of our soul. And I think it's intertwined, interwoven into the very fabric of your physiology, your psychology, and the spacesuit you live in, this sack of water you're in, is all tentacled up with your soul. And that it has a real substance and a real essence. And what God told me, I believe, and us when we left home was, I want you to go down into this experience and I want you to listen. I want you to listen for my voice. I want you to hear what I would ask you to do to complete your journey. I will be there for you. I will help you. I will guide you. But you have to find me and you have to listen. And all the noise that we come into in this life, if you weren't an adult child, is enough to keep most people distracted. From childhood to today, I know this isn't my daddy's USA. This is a different country than it was 40, well, I'm 57 now, so 57 years ago, where we didn't have real time events coming in on us all the time. I never played a Game Boy. I still can't stand the damn things. But I understand now that kids are being pulled all the time away from this internal search for themselves. Some philosophers say that the day that you are born, the moment of your birth, is the first real spiritual divorce you experience in this life, and that you spend the rest of it trying to get back. So I think God sends us down, asks us to listen, to find ourselves, to listen to what he asks us to do, to then do it, and then come home. And it's that simple. But it's not that easy to talk about. And when we deal with the spirituality aspects of our recovery, you know, as well as I do, that people can get kind of glassy-eyed with you when you start talking about God and spirituality. So I try to boil it down. Now, in my private practice, of course, as a clinician, I don't speak of religious issues, and I can't tell you honestly that I'm a religious man. I'm a spiritual man. I have a strong connection. God upstairs is a friend of mine. But I do not preach this material to my clients. That's not ethical. I try to help them understand, though, that we have dimensions of ourselves, you know, the emotional, the psychological, the physical, the spiritual. And I start telling them, if you want to find your sobriety, if you want to find your identity, you are going to have to at some point accept a powerlessness in your life so that you don't try to keep defining who you are from the outside in. And children are developmentally incompetent to define themselves until they reach an age of maturation. And we, you know, guesstimate and theory and research says it's probably around age 17 to 18 that the brain has at least moved through its biggest explosive developmental stage by age 16 or 17. At that point, we are supposedly containing fundamental cornerstones of our understanding of ourselves so that we can go out and have a life. We don't have to go out and relive our mommy and daddy's lives. We have differentiated ourselves from our parents. And so in this spiritual journey and these triads of recovery that I want to talk to you about, I really want to focus as much of the time as I have with you on the idea of our adulthood. I know there's a child within my soul. I know you have one too. And you guys have gotten in, gals have gotten into lots of trouble with that because you listened to your feelings and then you reacted to what you felt. And this is how children live. They do not filter it through an intellectual or moral screen. They filter it through the way they feel. So anything that a child feels to them is the truth. If you have been then an adult living as a child in that spacesuit, the world impacts you. It taps into some of your memories of the past. And you start feeling today like you did then. Now you're lost in time. You're in a time warp. You're a child walking around in an adult body. You know all of the feelings that we have. That, you know what free-floating anxiety is? Okay? And why do they call it free-floating? because it's not attached to anything. Infant, the word infant means pre-verbal, and certainly during that time in your life, you do not have the synaptic chemistry and maturity to create memories that will last forever. Unless you are tremendously traumatized, unless there's some very unique event that stirs up a lot of good chemistry to form a memory bank, most of you will move through your early 4 or 5 years, and today if I asked you, you could not give me a good accounting of that. But the emotional residue is with you. It's in the core of you. I call it your private logic. It's where a child builds a foundation of ideas about the world. They don't have memories attached to it anymore. This is confusing to us, why we feel certain ways. But we feel what we feel, and we believe it. So Sharon and I are talking about all this, and I said to her one day, there isn't just alcoholics and codependents. There are only adult children who sometimes come to alcoholism, sometimes come to drug addiction. But I have never met an alcoholic, as I was saying to you earlier, who is not an adult child of some kind of dysfunctional family. Now, I list out three of them in most of my writings, but I talk about the chemically dependent family, I talk about the mentally ill family, I talk about the physically abusive family, and mixed in there is a rigid fundamentalistic family. I don't mean just religious. You know, some people are raised by sergeants and you know, lieutenants and those kinds of things. Where the world is so narrowly defined that you can't be okay if you step outside these corridors. If you can't step out the corridor and live your soul out as a child in a safe environment where you begin to define who you are and your parents are healthy enough and they're not children, so they don't get intimidated by your creativity, they are there to discipline you. They are there to guide you. They are there to support you and love you. But they are not there to tell you that you can't be who you are. However, that's not what happens to most of us. We come through that kind of experience as an adult child, knowing as we enter adulthood that we are supposed to be acting in a certain way in order to get what? Approval and love. And so we start to master all these skills. We are master manipulators, you and I. We are adaptive people. We're quick studies. And I've never met a stupid person in my office, never. And I don't mean to sound disrespectful, but if God did not give someone the gift of enough gray matter between their ears, you'd never meet them in a therapist's office. Because it takes a lot of brains to get this screwed up. And you have to spend an awful lot of energy twisting the truth into things that you think are real when there's no evidence to support it, and then act like it is. And when someone challenges you, you feel what? Threatened. You're telling me I'm wrong. You're telling me I'm not okay. But this is my belief. This is my core. This is who I am. And they're so sincere. And you know what sincere delusion is? It's that person who's not lying to you. They're telling you exactly the truth as they see it. So if you said to them in your coarseness or your reactivity, you're lying to me, they would be threatened by you. So when I'm sitting in my office and I meet an adult child and they're telling me these stories and my little kid inside is going, oh, bullshit, you know. But I'm an adult and I look at them and I go, And then I look at them and I say, so, Tom, you really believe what you just got done saying? Yes, absolutely. And you're an honest man, right, Tom? I absolutely am an honest man. And you wouldn't want to distort or lie or manipulate what you're saying to me, would you? No, 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 no. And I said, well, I don't understand a damn thing you said. And what do they think about me? There's something wrong with you. I've had them say, well, you're not a very good therapist. Well, you're not listening. And I said, no, I am listening. Maybe I'm the first person who's really trying to listen to you and stop in front of you and say, I love you and I believe in you, but I don't believe a thing you're saying to yourself. And I'm afraid you and I aren't going to have a relationship if you can't get honest with yourself. And some of the people that come into therapy are doing rehab. Rehab is different than habilitation, by the way. But most adult children are not coming to therapy to do rehab. They haven't got anything to go back to. They have come to start something. That's habilitation. And most of the therapy that used to go on 30 years ago, psychoanalytically speaking, didn't understand addiction, didn't understand that these people didn't have an identity. In fact, the phraseology for you and I before we came to adult childhood was, from the psychoanalytic level, undifferentiated ego mass. You ever heard that? Yeah. Sounds like psychobabble, but not to them. It's very descriptive terminology that says your ego is undifferentiated. You don't know the difference between your emotions and your thoughts and your morality. Consequently, you are acting as a child, and in the world, you are building your identity from the outside in and not the inside out. In clinical terms, they talk about that as your locus of control. I want to teach you these words so when you're talking to people, you can be educated to people who look at you and go, you went to a what meeting for a what weekend? You talked about a what? What is that all about? And you want to say to them the things that will register. You can't just start bleeding and telling them the whole story of your family's life. They'll go, too much information. I didn't really want to know that much. And so when you talk to adult children, you have to be careful, particularly the ones who haven't had any real work done with them yet, because they'll tell you how to build a watch. You ask them what time it is, and they'll tell you everything about their lives. It's like those jokes we have about adult children going out on dates. And they meet a normal person, and they go, and my story is that my mother was an alcoholic, committed suicide when I was 14. My dad, you know, he left home. I haven't seen him for 25 years. I've been on medication and therapy for, you know, and the person with you going, oh, my God, I'm out of here. So Sharon and I and others are beginning to find one another. Have you heard of the 100th monkey theory?
Yeah.
This is what's happening. It was a groundswell back in 85 when finally someone was saying there are adult children of alcoholic families out there. It would be okay for us to talk about it. And they came out of the woodwork. They didn't know why they were coming, but they knew when they read that in the newspaper that that was the conference they had to go to. And so we started to see that this whole continuum of addiction, alcoholism, and chemical dependency was founded on, in large sense, a spine, a strong column of distorted, calcified emotional confusion that was causing an individual, not just because they were genetically predisposed to alcoholism, it was pushing an individual who felt separated from their own soul for a medication from the pain, a medication from the free-floating anxiety about that which they could not remember any longer but knew was a problem. And how is it, the mystery, that if you go to a party as an adult child and you're not recovering, you're going to find the other adult child in the room or the alcoholic adult child in the room, and you're going to fall in love with one another? I mean, there is no such thing as mature intimacy for unrecovering alcoholics and unrecovering adult children. They go to reenact what? Their childhood, their parents' lives. We grow up typically like one parent, mimic their behavior, try to seek pride and validation from them, even in the negative sense, if that's what's required. And then we go out and we find the partner and we marry our other parent. And so you see, a child is going to carry this unfinished business with them across their lifetime. And they are going to try to resolve why it feels the way it does to them through reenactment with another person. And they're going to keep repeating this behavior until they look in the mirror and see, it isn't about me, it's my mom and dad. I never emancipated. I never left home. I don't have my own life yet. I live out of the reservoir of clouds and confusion in my history. So this was a horrendous shift in our thinking clinically at that time. It was just an amazing way to bring the fold of AA and Al-Anon people together and start a 12-step program that was saying, look, you get sober and the process will lead you, if you're an alcoholic, to this question of what Bill W., who is one of my heroes, one of the guys who I believe set the stage for everything we're doing here today, by calling his next stage in recovery emotional recovery. He wrote about it towards the end of his life. It may be hard to find, but it's in the archives. Look in the grapevine, 1958. And he's starting to talk about emotional recovery. He's talking about absolute surrender of everything you ever held on to try to give yourself a sense of worth. And in that effort to hang on to everything, he saw himself get depressed. He saw himself not drinking anymore, but connected to all these other things that he felt were keeping him from his freedom, his own life. They were weighing him down. Towards the end of his life, he didn't want to go to these big conferences. He definitely did not want to be identified as the father of AA. He didn't want that. He wanted to be free of it. He didn't know how to do that because he also had a sense of honor and responsibility. So he stayed, but he tried and tried and tried to talk more and more towards the end of his life about this idea of emotional recovery. So we get into understanding that adult children have little or no trust. Now, you have to understand a child will not survive if they don't successfully negotiate at least what we in clinical terms talk about half of the crisis that they have to face. The first crisis is trust. The second crisis is autonomy. The third crisis is initiative. The fourth crisis is industry. The fifth crisis is identity. And then the sixth crisis is intimacy. And where do adult children, I call it body by bondo, adult children do not and are not, this is a clinical argument, and I don't want to get into it with you, but I want you to know there's a clinical argument that's been going on for years about the issue of resilience versus adaptability. I am an adaptability proponent. I don't believe that children are resilient, though I understand in general what they're hoping to say, is that children somehow survive these terrible events. And I go, well, they do, and that's a genetic gift, eons old, that we've somehow managed to get out of our environment exactly what we need to get through it, even though we're lacking so much. What I'm really saying, though, is you and I are adaptive people. Because we're smart, we took in that pain, and we found a way to cope with it. Adult children make up layers and layers and layers of denial and excuses and rationalizations, so that when you ask them about their family of origin, they tell you often in the beginning, I had a great family. Things were great. And then when you start to introduce them to more people who are past that point of denial, they start getting scared and they tell you things. This is the rap, the quick words that flop right out of the mouths of adult children. My mom and dad did the best they could at the time they did with the skills they had. And I go, absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. I validate adult children all the time, first off, and then I tell them they're wrong later. Your mom and dad did not do the best they could. It wasn't that they were guilty of being bad people. It was that they were adult children, another generation, living in denial, married to another adult child. And remember, these aren't emancipated, differentiated souls. These are children. Raising children in a time in history when the greatest generation, the people who died so you and I could be here, you know, went out and didn't have a thought about what they felt. And thank God they didn't. If they'd have stopped to think about it, they'd never been able to do what they did. So maybe God has a perfect plan, but here we are. They did what they had to do to make a better life for their children. I know my dad believes that. He's still alive. He's 92. My mother's passed now. But she believed that, and they were of that generation, and many of you in this room know what I'm talking about. Stoic, kind of northern European stock, who spoke never about how they felt, saw much ugliness in their lives. And their children suffered under the emotional immaturity of their intimate struggles with one another. Some of them drank, some of them got mentally ill. Often women were the ones who ended up in the psychiatrist's office. And by the way, if you're a therapist, anybody here a therapist? A few of you? I don't know about you, but my experience is men don't come to therapy. Women bring men to therapy. And they don't come voluntarily, though they say they are. I'm here because I want to learn. No, I don't think you really want to learn. You want to get her off your back, you know? In any case, I digress. Can't help it once in a while. I'm an adult child and I'm dyslexic, by the way. So, staying focused, I want to take you through not the issue any longer of how the history of adult child movement grew, not about how we all got screwed up as children, But how do we make that passage into what Bill W. talked about is emotional recovery? This is where the triads for adulthood come into my life. And I want to tell you this. I don't have them in triads because I have any preconceived notion of their divinity. I only think that they are easier to remember, and I need to discipline myself to remember things. So I put them in this order across the page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And when you and I start to develop our sobriety, and I'm talking about emotional sobriety for those of you who are not the addicts here, you know as well as I do that the child in your soul has a drug store of ways to medicate the way you feel. It can be work, it can be sex, it can be cleaning the damn house, it can be driving cars too fast, it can be going to work too much, it can be going to the gym too much, it can be sleeping too much, it can be reading too many books. Adult children going into a bookstore for the first time. I mean, one of the first adult child interventions I did was in a bookstore. I was there to do one of these things for the publishers, and this gal came up to the desk, and she had my book and about 15 other ones. And I said, "So you're an adult child?" She said, "How'd you know?" And I said, "Well, the number of books you have suggests that you're kind of anxious about getting things straightened out, and you think maybe if you read all this, you're going to get an answer." The problem with that is, but it's typical of adult children, they'd rather read a book because they don't want to talk to you because you might say something back to them. But the book is there for their own interpretation, even if it's written very clearly. And after they get loaded up with information, they can go out and give lectures on adult childdom. And that some of them do. They do. They give lectures on this stuff. I've met some of them on the road. But they couldn't relationship themselves out of a wet sack. And they're in this corkscrewed experience where now they have become more sophisticated at being dysfunctional. Okay? And so therapists who don't understand addiction, I'm a bilingual therapist, I tell people, because I know addiction. And I know the clinical stuff, so I can sit down with the clinical anals and I can talk about that and lay my license on the table and go, "Okay, now we stop all the crap." We can just talk about what's happening here to our clients. I can sit down with the addict and say, "You know, yeah, I'm a licensed psychologist, but that doesn't mean I don't understand what addiction's all about. Doesn't mean I don't understand what it meant to grow up in an alcoholic family." You need to decide if you are ready to do this work. This is really hard work, I tell my clients. And I'm a really selfish guy. "You are?" And I go, "Absolutely. I work a program that says this is a selfish program." And when you say that to the newcomer, how many of you heard that first time and went, "This doesn't feel right"? Any of you? Yeah. Because you've been raised with an idea that if you kept your focus on caring about everybody else, God would bless you, you'd be blessed. And what I think a lot of parents who were saying that were trying to tell us was that if you get in here too much, you're going to get hurt and scared and lonely and sad and depressed, and because that was my experience, so stay out there, okay? Don't go in here. It's too painful. So you and I are going along this developmental road, and we come to now sobriety. And someone starts asking us about our family, and we don't lie anymore. We start telling the truth. When we first got to these adult-child meetings and conferences, let me tell you, there were a lot of anxious children inside adult bodies. And if you want danger, just turn loose a bunch of adults who have been waiting for 30 years to have a good time. And some of the stuff that used to go on in those conferences just scared the crap out of me. And I'd come in and I'd sit down and start talking with them. And I'd say, "Look, I know how to play with your emotions because I'm an adult child. I can make you cry and I can make you laugh. I can make you want to go home and not listen to another thing I have to say because I know how to manipulate other people to stay off of me. But this is a conference, and I'm not your therapist, and I'm going home when this is done. So I'm going to educate you, I'm going to give you some information, then I'm going to tell you that I believe you have come here by divine providence. You know in your soul you want something. You come and you say you want something, and then when someone asks you, you tell them you don't." Adult children are doing this all the time. "I love you, and I need you, and I want you, so get the hell out of my life." And you can't understand, why did you pick this person you met from across the room and you had to know her, you know? And she saw you, and women are more subtle, but she worked her way around and got to know you. And then you got together, and then you just hurt each other, just lied to each other, denied love to one another. But you love each other. You said that to each other. I know you did. I did this. I hurt lots of women down the road. And I remember thinking back, how could I possibly have been such an ass? Because I'm a good man. I never wanted to hurt anybody. But I couldn't get close to anyone. And when a woman is involved in a relationship, because that's what women are about, connection, okay? The attachment, connection. Men are about independence. So you come in and you want to know about me. Why? My kid was like, why do you want to know that? My first wife would say to me, well, what kind of food do you like? Hamburgers? Why do you care? Well, because, you know, I'm trying to be a good wife. And I went, just cook. I'll eat anything. I didn't want to share anything about me. When they'd ask me about my mother and my father, I said, yeah, my dad's, you know, Dr. Welby, and my mother is a social worker, and yeah, they're great people. No intimacy. Intimacy is into me see. And you don't want anybody to see into you if you're an adult child. Because why? What's the fear? And why are they going to hurt you if you let them in? What? Say it again.
Because they will abandon you?
Yes, abandonment's another one of our fears. Something's wrong with me and you're going to see it. And then I'm going to be sorry I ever showed it to you. And privately, I already know that I don't like who I am. I'm trying to be someone else. For some of us who drank, the story was, I drank to be someone. I said, let's go drink and be somebody. And my friend said to me one night, no, I don't want to. He said, I'd rather get drunk and be somebody else. I went, that's a good idea. But I came into AA, and as the program promises, I stayed, and I woke up, and slowly I started to come to terms with the emotional inebriety of my life. Now, I still go to my AA meetings on occasion, and I look around, and I sit down, and there are still people there that were there when I started, and they haven't changed a bit. This isn't a criticism about AA. This is about a child's journey, and you can find an addiction anywhere. The first triad that I want to talk to you about is, to me, the threshold of passage, if you will, into real adulthood. And it starts out with this question of surrender of, what's it say?
Blame.
When you and I stop blaming, because that's one of our drugs of choice. It's one of our best defenses. Either we do it under our breath or we do it out loud. But there's always someone else who caused whatever it was that made me to do whatever I did. And even if you are accurately inventorying, and we're all good inventory takers because you've been practicing for 30 years, of what other people did wrong, think about it. Logically speaking, after you get done with all the listing of the blame, what's been accomplished?
Nothing.
So you see, in this differentiating process, you move away from a feeling to a logic that says, there is no benefit in all this blame. It may help in hindsight to understand what mistakes went on so we don't repeat them. But at the moment these things are happening, you have to not be intoxicated by the temptation, as a child is always tempted to blame. And if you can move into sobriety from drinking and blame, you are on your way to adulthood. And the moment that you catch yourself not blaming, you'll feel it. You'll go, oh, that felt good. I like that. I'm feeling like an adult person. How many of you have wondered, I hope someday I'm going to know what it feels like to be an adult? This is something we want. We've heard about it. We were in a hurry to grow up so we could be that. The second thing on this list is acceptance of powerlessness. Now, in a world where you build from the inside out instead of from the outside in, your locus of control is now here and not out there. Like the program teaches us, you accept powerlessness over, and then you can plug anything you want into that first step. I am powerless over my alcohol. I am powerless over my my husband, my wife, my boss, my children. I have, however, the last of these things is what? Free will. This is God's greatest gift, I think, to everybody. That we're at the top of the food chain because we self-actualize. Because we can actually consciously choose not to do what we feel. We got lots of instincts and hormones and all that kind of stuff going on. Gets better as you get older, by the way. Slows down. But you have free will. The day you move through maturation around age 16 to 17, you started to have the conscious competence to make a choice to not think only about what might happen to you, but you might ask, what might happen to you? If I do this and that, what's the consequence of what I do? And I have free will. And I mean, if you're looking to have power, put your arms around the choice. And don't do anything until you have thought it through. My sponsor used to say, Bob, don't do anything until you come up with a fourth alternative. And why the fourth one? He said, because the first three are easy and they're always wrong. So I started to practice what I was told. And every time something happened, I'd think about, and the three things, what do you think the first three choices of an adult child might be? Reaction of fight, flight, or freeze. And that's what we always have done. Now the fourth choice would require that you do something brand new. Now, trust me, even if your fourth choice is not so good, it'll be new. And new is progress. And you're moving out of that old paradigm. You're getting out of the box. This is how your recovery begins to happen in the sense of emotional sobriety. And as you do that, you begin to differentiate your emotional from your intellectual. And if you're really lucky, you start to even feel the moral part of your soul coming back to life. Now, understand, I said to you earlier that people coming to therapy are not usually coming for rehab. They're coming to find a new beginning. They've got a pile on one end of a teeter-totter. It looks like a pile of dung. But adult children, hope springs eternal, there's got to be something good in there somewhere. Instead of putting new rocks over on this side. But that would require that you left your family of origin and you'd find your family of choice. And then you would listen to those elders, to those collective voices, to the collective wisdom of your group, and they would love you in ways you'd never been loved growing up, which will be bittersweet. How come these strangers I feel more love and connection to than my mother and my father? This makes adult children sad. Makes them glad. Scares the hell out of them. Gives them hope. Sends them into a lot of yin and yang. The second of these triads has to do with then adult discipline. And like the meetings you first went to told you, and like the big book says, keep it simple, stupid. Go to the meetings. And when you hear that little voice inside, I know you've heard this, and I'm not talking about literal voices, that's another diagnosis. I'm talking about that little kid in you who says, I don't want to. I'm tired. I don't like that guy that sits across from me in that meeting. I wish he'd stop coming, then I'd go. You know? You stop listening to that crap, and you go, no, I'm going to the meeting. And you feel yourself fighting with the steering wheel, but you make the turn, and you pull up to the parking lot, and you go in. And then as you do this, what comes over time is clarity. You go, I see. What it feels like to have free will, go to those meetings, have an hour, for God's sakes, in your life where you don't have to do anything but be yourself. You don't have to go to an AA meeting and worry, though I know you do until you catch on, that someone's going to confront you. When the truth is, the meeting has all sorts of very specific adult rules. You know the 12 steps? They are an adult program for living. That's all they are. They don't give a shit how you feel. They never ask you how you feel. Maybe the person might, but then they're not working their program. They don't care whether you believe in God. They don't ask you to become some kind of religious zealot. All they're saying is, do these things. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Just do them and keep repeating them. They all one to the other, fit together. So we get into discipline, clarity, and consistency. And as you do that, there are things that will start to come to you. The promises of this program will come to you. Suddenly, things that seem so perplexing to you seem so simple. The anxiety that used to hover over you all the time is now gone. The urge to get loaded the urge to go have another date, the urge to go to work instead of your meeting. All this stuff is lifted from you. You are differentiating into adulthood. This is a great emancipatory story. AA has emancipated more people than any other program in all of time. Saved more lives than any program in all of time. AA saved my life. Adult children, the ACA movement, saved my soul. This was the difference. It was the crossing bridge. You know, and Al-Anon was really about a program in the beginning for people who were too busy addicted to taking care of somebody else, that they weren't taking care of themselves. So I found it ironic when I first fought with the early Al-Anon people, and let me tell you, we had some really interesting arguments, about why adult children should be welcomed into Al-Anon family groups. Okay? And all the arguments that, no, this is for people who are married to alcoholics. And I go, okay, I guess we'll just have to. This is how the ACA movement started by itself, because Al-Anon wouldn't make room for it. Now, all things, all systems resist change in the beginning. That's normal, it's healthy, it's necessary. Otherwise, it'd just be chaos, right? But slowly but surely, the truth always surfaces like the seeds in the spring. If you think about, here's a word that I'd like you to think about. It's called the remnant. It's in theological histories. But remnant, while in sort of a contemporary thing, might mean something left over, the remnant in this biblical sense, theological sense, means the truth. Think about the remnant of the truth that came with you in your soul when you came into this life. That was with you. That truth was in you. It's still in you now. And you're fighting and working all the time to get better understanding to who you are and what am I doing here. So we get into the questions of living in the moment. You know about that. We talk about it. The here and now. This is where it's happening. It is right now. Okay, so I'm with you now. Do you think my little boy doesn't have someplace else he thinks he might like to go? So I'm competing all the time with a child who has an agenda, and he's got a short attention span. I'm, you know, a male. I want to say to him all the time, settle down, but I stop having arguments with my kid. I do not lecture a five-year-old. I don't try to have an intellectual conversation with the child in my soul anymore. I say to him, Bob, right now we're in San Diego, and we're with about 70 or 80 people. And we're going to be talking about recovery, so you can sit in your safety seat and play with your toys. And when we get done, we'll be going where we're going next. I'm staying in this moment because this is the moment where something you don't want to miss is happening. I tell God when I come to these things, I didn't ask to be here, God. You asked, I believe, by some other voice that came over the phone and called me. I'm here, and I'm going to be here for the one or the thousand. I don't care. I know there's something going on in this room right now between one of you and me. I don't know who you are. I don't know how many of you there are, but I know something's happening. You're going to take something, and I'm going to take something, and I'm going to go away with it. It's mine. I'll leave the rest. So if you hear anything that's coming out of my mouth today that means something to you, just take it, make it your own, because there's nothing new under the sun. I didn't make this shit up. This is stuff that was happening. This was evolving. We live in a time of emancipation from the dark ages, in revelation to ourselves. It's not a me sort of selfishness. It's a me kind of responsibility. And we get into these triads. We'll talk about it. The next thing in this list of living in the moment. I'm sorry, go ahead. Question here. Can... Right. The person is asking, is there an extreme you can take living in the moment? So it's sort of a eat, play, and be merry, and tomorrow we die. And I just want to say to you, absolutely, adult children can screw anything up. But I believe that when we're talking about sober intellectual moral discernment, you are about the job of balance in your life. But you understand that if you're going anywhere tomorrow, you have to start where you are, and that's today. Otherwise, you're going to go to tomorrow and start to repeat what is still not finished about yesterday, and it's going to keep going like that until you move beyond it. And we don't move forward in a vacuum. So we have groups. That's how we got together. I think if you understood the word religion, the word means to bind together. It didn't have any purpose that it has now become. It didn't have all this idea of ritualized practices. It didn't have anything about shame and guilt in it. It just said, if you want to keep your faith in God strong, then hang around with people who are in their life maturely trying to practice a relationship with God. Like AA says, stick with the winners. So we come to our groups because we find strength in numbers. We can find staleness there too, as the man in the back was asking. We can take it to an extreme. But when a group starts to all think the same, it'll die. Trust me. So we live in the moment, and we live in the sameness of this life. Now, I don't know about you, but I lived on a roller coaster ride for a lot of years and not knowing if it was
emotionally
getting up one more. And that wasn't because I was drinking anymore. It was because I had a child in my soul running around like a BB in a boxcar, wondering if I was going to show up for whatever the life that I was living was going to bring to me today. You ever had that anxiety? It's the free-floating stuff. You live in that roller coaster emotion, and then you get sick and tired of being sick and tired till finally some brilliant insight comes to you and you go and ask a therapist for help, or you talk to your friend who you know has been an ACA or whatever that wacky stuff she was or he was doing before. Now suddenly it's interesting to you. And when you start to find the calmness in your soul that comes in the collective wisdom, and I tell all my clients, particularly the men, I say, look, it took 10 men to stop me. I believe it's going to take 10 men to stop you. And if I can't invite you to come and be a part of one of our men's groups, I tell you, you're wasting your money with me one-on-one, because $155 an hour is a poor expenditure of your dollar. I can't help you like 10 could help you. And I can't give you the perspective that 10 can give you. And this is what I believe from the program that saved my life. So come and be a part of a process. Join a family. Well, I'm not a group person, Bob. I know. I know you're not. I can tell. And after you've lived on that roller coaster for all those years, you get sobriety started, and you feel this sort of serenity come. You remember that? Wow, no red lights in my rearview mirror. You know, I'm not worried about what my husband or my wife's going to say. I'm not worried about talking about my feelings as much as I used to be. It's going to be okay. It's going to be all right. I'm calm. I'm cool. I like this. And then about 10 or 15 days of liking it and going along really nice pass. And then what does the little child in your soul start saying about this recovery thing? This is boring. I mean, boring. There's no fun here. Because his soul, her soul, is connected to chaos. Chaos feels normal, even though they hate it. They don't want it. They hate it. But they don't trust it. What is it they don't trust? Is it the environment of people they don't trust? Is it outside of you, the trust you lack? It's inside you. You look in the mirror and you see that person staring back and you say, you don't give a shit about me. You don't care about me. I've seen you. You take care of everybody else, not me. When I go out there, I'm on my own. But if someone else is bleeding, oh, you're just so kind. You're just so good. You're right over there fixing it for them. And you don't see, and I don't see how that was one of our medications of choice. I mean, I could love you. I just love you. I just care about you. I love you, you know, because it makes me not have to deal with the person I don't feel I love. Now, interestingly enough, if you think about ego states, children cannot self-define. Children cannot self-validate. Then you think about what it takes for a child to become a whole person. It takes people to validate them. It takes people to bring them through the trust, the autonomy, the initiative, the industry, to the identity of their lives and into real intimacy with another soul. It takes all that energy from the outside in. And you and I are built evolutionarily or by divine design, I don't care what your argument is. Somehow it came to pass that we are a three-dimensional creature. We have feelings, we have thoughts, and we have morality. I don't know why we think there should be a right and wrong in the world, but it's in there somewhere because we've done research with children and we see. Children reflect a desire for right and wrong before they are impacted by the social signatures around them. They want something to be fair. They know there's a right and wrong. They feel guilty about things they did. Of course, the next moment they could do it again. But they feel bad in the moment. So you and I are struggling all the time to get out of the chaos. And when you start to get real emotional sobriety, you feel a joy about how everything is the same. And you start saying prayers. Dear Lord, please help me make today as good and as calm and quiet as yesterday was. And if there's chaos that comes my way, help me think about what my choices are before I act. So you go through this triad and you start to mature. You accept it's not boring. In fact, we're going to talk about that in one of the later triads. But you understand you are coming to your adulthood. Are we okay on time here, or am I supposed to be done? Oh, good. I hate not finishing well. So if you cross over the line here, you get into this question about what are the externalized gratifiers in our life? And inside we have come to deludedly believe. When I say I want you, that means that I have to have you. And if I can't, then something's wrong. My life is not complete. And if I say I need you, then I believe that. And I start to listen to our English language. We got the most sloppy language of any language in the whole world because you don't know what word means what exactly. But I say I need as a child, and trust me, a child believes they need this thing. When a child says I want that, they can't get their mind off of it. They want it. And as an adult person, as a moral, sober adult person, you begin to recognize there is nothing you need but water, air, food, shelter. It would be nice, all the other things, but you don't have to have them. And when you stop feeling that anxiety about I'm in deficit all the time, then things get better for you. And you feel more whole, more joy, more sobriety, more serenity, all the good stuff that the promises tell you you're going to have. It's hard to change your language, but I'm going to ask you now to think about this through the rest of the workshop and into, as long as you remember being here. Think about when the word want is going to come out of your mouth and stop yourself. And see how hard it is to find another word to put in there. Instead of saying need, stop yourself from saying that and find another word to put in there. Do this for yourself. It's a discipline. Builds on one of the triads that we talked about earlier. Discipline, clarity, and consistency. I therefore speak deliberately with you. I do not lay upon you the misguided notions of my child that I have to have something, that I want to have something, that I need to have something. And the highest spiritual surrender is no ownership. You don't own the house in the sense that you live in it like it's a measure of your worth. It is a gift. It's a privilege. You earned the right, perhaps, to have that. But it isn't something you want to own and hang on to because it'll drag you down. So if it burns down, would you get down on your knees and say, God, thanks for taking that away. I know there's something else that will replace it. But I'm still here. My wife, my kids are still here. This is just a shelter. It's a good thing. It's a nice thing. I feel privileged to have been able to care for it. I have been blessed in ways with my family that we have this lake place that we found. One of those accidents in life. Just a beautiful spot. We didn't have a lot of money, but it was some woman who was angry at her children who were angry at her for being an alcoholic. And so they abandoned her, and she abandoned them in her hurt feelings and sold the property for a song. Well, when we took that over, I remember going up there for the first time and saying, Lord, bless this place. Keep this place sanctified. Don't let harm come to any soul that steps on this land. Because I don't own it. I will care for it because it's a gift. And until it's mine to turn over to someone else, let me always be a caretaker of this place. And, people are hooked on money and people are hooked on material stuff, and it's tempting in our world. And we know everyone sings for your supper here. You live in a capitalistic society, and you're not going to get anywhere if you don't make an effort to care for yourself. But there are people who are envious and jealous all the time. They want, they think they need, And I have people come up to visit, and I'll bring clients up there on a retreat every year. And I hear, you know, these guys saying, wow, this property is really valuable. You could make a lot of money if you sold this off. And I quietly in here, I hear my parent and my soul say, God help this man understand the cancer of his thinking, the loss of his soul. Because you can't keep anything. It's not yours. The body you're in isn't yours. In the end, it's going to go away. And then you have the answer that you will get an insight into when it sheds from you. And I've had a lot of discussions about these triads with clients. And in this particular set of triads, and in deference to the women in the audience, I want to tell you, I have never had a woman yet tell me that she resonates to these three issues like men tell me they resonate to them. They say they are concepts in their minds, but there are other words they would use to describe their seeking of honor, nobility, self-respect. And I don't know if that's a gender issue. Much to learn yet before I die. But I wonder if there is anyone here, any of you ladies who, when we're done talking today, would give some thought to this, and if you want to share it with me, I'd be more than willing to listen. But as a man, I can speak with great confidence in the idea that when I solved, we're going to talk about some of this tonight at the dinner, after dinner talk. Men have to solve the paradox of their self-centeredness. Okay? I do not apologize for being a man. I don't apologize for being self-centered. I think evolutionarily speaking, I was built to be self-centered. I don't think it's right to apply that as some sort of excuse for brutality or insensitivity or lack of sincerity or lack of compassion. But I am not a weakling when it comes to the notion that I have a responsibility to serve myself first in order to serve those that I love. And so in that sort of selfish, healthy notion, I believe that if I stop trying to gratify myself from the outside, that is like an ownership and want and need, and say to myself that because of my free will every day, if I conduct myself at the end of the day in a way during the day that I can feel honor and nobility in, that I can take home with me. That I can take with me when I shed this body. That's a part of my soul I'm going to keep. So I think, go ahead, someone. Yes, I think the question was that he said, I'm repeating this again, that our society does us a disservice by not really doing a very good job of differentiating between healthy narcissism and unhealthy narcissism. But you and I are all self-centered creatures at the core. We don't do anything that ultimately we don't believe for one reason or another doesn't serve us. And I'm just saying you discern morally, you discern intellectually, which is the right or wrong choice. But some of the most selfish people are some of the greatest in our history. And I don't mean those that brutalized. I mean those that kept their dream. I think about two of them in particular. I think about Abraham Lincoln. I believe that this man, for some reason, knew in his soul that his destiny was to do everything he could to keep this union from falling apart. I don't think it was about slavery for him at the core. I think that was an issue, but peripheral to his soul's understanding of his mission. And that was to keep this country together at all costs, risk everything, knowing, and I think if any of you have studied his life, he had dreams and visions of his own death. Didn't stop him, though. He knew he had to do what he had to do. And so I see him as a great man because I never saw him trying to seek greatness. I saw him trying to be who he was. Okay? Another great figure to me is more contemporary, and that's Mother Teresa. You think about this woman. Talk about self-centered. And the church got rid of her because she wouldn't do what they wanted. But she knew she had this thing going with the man upstairs, and there was no way she was going to break her word to the guy. So she went on and did it until they couldn't not have her back in because it looked bad for him. So she just, you know, she cut through all this stuff because she didn't abandon this self-centered belief, this selfish notion that this was her calling. She had to do this. Yes. That she was what? God-centered? God-centered. Oh, yes, absolutely you can say that. But then I believe if you and I were to talk in length about this question of spirituality, we are all God-centered. I think God is in us. I think we may not choose to listen, and I think that's part of the journey of our emancipation into spiritual sobriety, that we surrender to the existence of God in us and see God in everyone around us, so that I don't have to be afraid of you anymore, because I'm not worried about whether you love me or don't like me or don't care about me. I am only selfishly going to ask, after I'm, what is your name, by the way? Ed, after I'm done today, I will remember how I treated you, Ed, and I will take that home with me. Whatever our discourse here today does in your life, I don't know. But honestly, I want you to hear me tell you that I think we're all God-centered. And I believe that some are more blessed in the end in the vision of clarity that burns in their soul that tells them what to do. But I want you to know I have the power of knowing. I have heard my own voice, and I know what I'm supposed to do, and it's none of your damn business, but I am going to do it. Because one of the triads in here we're going to talk about tonight, I'll get to, builds on this theme. But I think we're all God-centered, and I just think it's a shame when people can't find that in their lives. So we get into the question. So again, if you ladies would give some thought to this, anybody has any ideas, I'm certainly willing to hear it from a gender-specific kind of way. But the question of nobility and honor is just an everyday part of my prayer and everyday a part of my walk. It is so self-centered, I got to tell you. It's like I can't fail. I look at every day and I go, you know, this is a no-lose proposition. All I have to do is get up, suit up, and show up. And all I have to do is treat you with the same kind of dignity and respect that I treat myself with. And then I know whatever's going to happen, the best it can will. No regrets. This is a big one for adult children. Big, big deal. How do we look back on our lives and not have that word come up in our soul? I so regret the time I wasted. I so regret that I can't ever have that time back. And regrets are just sins that are unforgiven. It is that you and I struggle to forgive ourselves. And one of the paradoxes of our adult childhood is that often we don't feel worthy as people because we were children who didn't feel worthy, who didn't understand that it really wasn't about us, it was our mom and dad's troubles, but we didn't know how to solve that problem, so the way we solved it was by saying, maybe if I was just a better little girl, maybe if I was just a smarter little boy, maybe if I hadn't been born, maybe even, things would have been better for my mother and father. And that becomes internalized into the private logic of a child. And so they work very hard. You and I, particularly as adult children, struggle and work very hard to be good people because we are trying to always make up for some part of us that feels we're never going to be worthy. And I can tell you 32 years later, my kid still believes, this is my personal journey, but my kid believes I'm not worthy. I don't know why this is. I haven't been able to untie that knot. I can't remember an event that made it so, but it's there. My wife and I talk about this, and we found each other because water seeks its own level for good or bad. But we were good people beyond our own belief in ourselves. And we saw that goodness in each other, and we have given that to one another over the 28 years we've been together. And so the maturity of that is a salvation and a saving grace in love and intimacy. But I can't tell you in my private, personal journey that my little boy has yet surrendered the idea that he is not unworthy. And maybe that's a good thing because I've, you know, it's caused me to strive all my life to be a good person. Even though at times feeling I never am going to accomplish that. I understand it's a child. I know my child is wrong. But I don't argue with him. I go, I know, Bob, you don't think you're worthy. You're not in God's book of life. You're going to hell. The slide's greased. You're on it, you know. But I say, I love you, and I know God loves us. So we're going to go on today, and enough of that conversation, Bob. Not going to talk to you about it anymore. So you and I are looking for our spirituality and our wholeness in this journey. And I don't have the regrets, though. This is the good piece. It isn't about whether my kid would want to hang on to those regrets because he has the memories. Your kid has the memory bank of everything you ever did wrong. You know this. And you could judge yourself and probably have pretty harshly more than anyone else. But as an intellectual and moral person, you have decided that he, she is wrong. And a child is innocent. The child in my soul is innocent. He was innocent whenever this stuff happened, and he's innocent now. I'm not saying that I'm not therefore held accountable if I let him go out and do something wrong. But if I do something wrong, I'll tell you who's really the culprit. It's the intellectual and moral part of me that failed to step up to the plate. Didn't work his program. Didn't take ownership for this weighty thing called life. Did you have a question? Oh, okay. Sorry. Disappointment. This is a word that you and I all hear from memories gone by. Someone looked at you, probably a parent, some adult caregiver, and said, "I am so disappointed in you." And it cut right through you, and it just grabbed you, and it validated something was wrong with you. And that shame feeling came over you. Because shame is that feeling you get, right, because you're a bad person, not because you did something wrong. You're really broken. You're kind of a flawed piece of machinery. That's what shame is to me. But that word disappointment is a word that you need to take out of your vocabulary. Again, I'd ask you to take it out. Catch yourself every time you get ready to use that word because it's sloppy, simple, easy, and it's wrong. It never works. No boredom. This is where we come back to what we were talking about earlier. When my kid says, "I'm really bored," I go, "We're in the moment, Bob. Right now, right here, this is what's happening. And I'm going to be here until we're done with this moment, and then we're going to go to the next moment." And that keeps me sober. Faithfulness, hope, and charity. Someone has a question here.
I didn't quite understand what you meant about no disappointment.
To say disappointment is a... I'm sorry, I did not complete that thought. She said, "I didn't understand what you said about no disappointment." When you say, "I am disappointed," you are really saying, "This didn't turn out the way I wanted it to." Who said you were supposed to have it turn out the way you wanted it to? It turned out the way it turned out. Whatever you did to play your part in that dance is up to you to look at. But why be disappointed when it didn't turn out, as opposed to saying, "It turned out the way it was supposed to"? It's not that it isn't in your voice, in your little boy or your little girl. I'm just saying catch her or catch him and go, "No, that's a judgment that it isn't the way it's supposed to be. It happened. It is. It's done. Now what are we going to do about it, remember?" Mm-hmm. Don't blame. Get on the choice-making bandwagon and do something different. Yes, question. A statement.
For me,
yes.
When I hear you talk,
yes.
For me, it's real intellectual.
It is.
And I know that to talk to those little parts of me,
yes.
Excuse me, that I have to acknowledge them, that I don't just say, "This is how it turns out," or this, meaning I have to say to myself,
the person is saying that you need to address the child inside you, not just intellectually, but somehow validate that these events took place.
And that's how those parts of myself, including the adult part, that's how I feel.
We have about 3 minutes, so I'm going to be real quick here.
That's
but you're not wrong, and I support what you're saying. This is, unfortunately, a limited amount of time I have to shove 10 pounds into a 5-pound sack. And I am being a little intellectual, but I don't want you to misunderstand me. You have a feeling that's a fact. You don't invalidate those feelings. I said to my child on many occasions, "I understand you're disappointed. I understand you think in your own naive way that it should have turned out different, that it wasn't fair. And I can even agree with you that the world isn't fair, son. But I'm telling you right now, I'm not having an argument with you about it because we need to move on, and that's yesterday's business to me. I love you. God loves you. Sit in your seat. Everything will be fine." And I believe as good parents, you are disciplined, clear, and consistent. Whether you say you love them all the time, maybe gravy and frosting, but that you were clear, consistent, and disciplined is the surest way not to screw up a child. Be there for them. Give them your best. Love them the best you know how. Don't be disappointed in them. Don't ever say that to them. You know? I'm going to have to hold a question. I'll tell you what, I'll talk with you. I'll stay around. We can talk, but he's running out of tape.
That is, the inner child also has a very healthy part that we need.
Please don't misunderstand. I am only talking right now about your responsibility from an intellectual and moral point of view to take care of a very mercurial soul who is on all levels innocent, whether you describe them as selfish or you describe them as loving. Doesn't matter to me. It's all descriptive adjectives about children. All I'm saying is that a child unsupervised is a child who's in a crisis. So we get down to, I don't know which where I left off here now. Faithfulness. Faithfulness, the idea that you and I can be truthful and we can be true to ourselves. This is that axiom on the coin in our program. To thine own self be true. That faithfulness is going to guide you to faithfulness with others. It is a selfish program to love somebody else. Trust me, I am telling you from all of the experience I have that the issue isn't the old saying about love thy neighbor as thyself. People screw that up not because they don't try to love their neighbors, but they do not love themselves faithfully. And so they try to get something from out there and it screws it up. Hope, my child is, speaking of the well of hopefulness, my child in that old idea of hope springs eternal in the heart of a child. My child believes that the world is all going to be at peace in my lifetime. He really thinks that that can happen. He believes if we just have enough faith, if we just meet enough people who have that kind of faith, then by God, you know, all those terrorists, those people want to tear your heart out, they're all going to change. I love you for that, kid. I love you for that, but you're intoxicated and you can't drive. You know, charity, we're going to talk some more about that tonight too, but I like to say to people, you know, be a part of the solution, not the problem. You know, put out more than you took in. Try to do this for your own sake and for the sake of the God of your understanding. Loyalty, integrity, confidence. Loyalty I'll leave for you, and I'll talk about some of these tonight. Maybe you can ask me some questions later. Some of them are fairly self-explanatory. I think you know what being loyal means. You say you're going to do something, you do it. And the only reason you would change and not do that is because you saw that there was an error in your thinking and that it would do more harm to continue this dance than to stop it. Then you make amends, but that's an honest mistake. I can live with an honest mistake. I don't like to live with the ones when I knew I should have stopped and I didn't listen. Integrity, that means that you are a person of your word. You are a person who gives in the way that is measured against your own belief in what is important. I do not try to take care of you because I can't stand your pain. I recognize that's God's problem to take care of your pain. My responsibility is to give you whatever God gave me to offer up at that moment and then move on. Confidence is a really important word. It means to live with faith. Defiance means to live without faith. And I believe people who work these triads and work their programs and find their identity become confident people. This isn't arrogance. This is confidence. When you meet a stranger, you're not anxious. You make eye contact because you're confident. It's another soul. It's another one of God's children. It's just not my problem what you're up to. It's what I'm up to. Grace, you've watched people in your life who you have seen from a distance or maybe up close who have a kind of grace about them. They are just not tangled up in all of whatever is happening. They will listen to you and they will sometimes, like elders do, smile and go, yes, life is like that. But they don't have to get into a diatribe with you and debate with you about every nuance and every syllable of the words you just used. Forgiveness. Now, this one is not easy because some things have happened to us in our lifetimes by others, perpetrated upon us, that I say to my clients, look, if you can't find that forgiveness, then don't hear me judging you. Then don't forgive. Be true to yourself. If that is a violation of the love you feel you have to keep for your child's sake, then don't give it away. God will forgive you if that's a mistake. Love, this is that greatest gift thing.